parents, look, I did my math homework.
What are we paying all this money for?
All right, last thing, I have my clicker, but. So maybe since we won't have a lot of folks here, maybe Nick's very conversational. Oh, you know what, now I can plug you in right here.
Oh, there we go. All good. Because Sam's using all the electricity.
So much of the ground.
All the electricity. He's using all the current, he's currently using.
That one going?
Yeah.
Okay. I could tweet them, retweet myself, this is so much easier. I couldn't remember the password. I'm going to retweet myself on my other account because I don't know the password to my other account.
Okay.
I'm special.
We still have 30 whole seconds before it's time, so maybe we'll wait.
For that last minute rush.
Yeah.
Lisa was gonna come back, but she has to go check in with the little rooms first to make sure she's okay, so.
Goodness.
We can just start.
Okay. Peggy, you wanna kick us off and just.
Okay.
I'll kick us off.
So, the way that this manifestation of this came about was that I had submitted something about my perspective, and it really was my personal journey in leadership, being a classroom teacher, because much of my time in the classroom, I already saw myself as an advocate. I was already doing a whole lot. My way of phrasing this very often is that I came to education late and got pissed off early, because I was a career changer, and I came into teaching in California right before the math wars hit, and they hit very, very hard and very, very locally, and I got very, very angry on behalf of the kids in my classroom. And it was not until 15 years later of doing both that I finally said, okay, you know, you've had two day jobs now, pick. And then I actually stepped out to do more full-time advocacy work, at least for a short period of time. And what I often find is that there are not clear avenues for teachers of how to do that. It's not an easy thing to figure out. There's not a well-described landscape for what it means to be an advocate or to even be working to further professionalize or to speak on behalf of the profession while you have a full-time teaching job and all that entails if you're really trying to do that justice and to honor the kids in your classroom. And so part of my thinking around this was just, I'll tell you what I figured out, because it might help you to fast track some of the things that you're trying to figure out and some of the places that you may not have looked at or thought about as, this might actually help me to speak better. This might actually give me entree to be heard in places that might matter. And then lo and behold, when the schedule came out, turns out that Levi had put in to present his piece. And were we talking about something else, or you basically reached out to me and said, hey?
Yeah, basically, so my piece is, if I haven't had a chance to talk to you, since I work with the Department of Education in Oklahoma, and one of my big interests is empowerment of teachers. So teacher agency is a huge concern and focus of mine. So I've been having all of these conversations and building up some of my own kind of theories, and we have some projects that are going on in Oklahoma. And whenever I saw that our ideas were so related, we basically pitched to Lisa that we would just combine our sessions. And the point being is that we feel like we have some experiences that are worth sharing, but we have a lot more questions than we have answers. And that's something that we want to kind of get out there today. So anyway, so I appreciate, just so everybody knows, I sincerely appreciate that we've combined the sessions. I think hopefully we'll cover some good stuff. So so one of the things, because I know a lot of people will be asking this, I'm not in the classroom, and you are not in the K-12 classroom.
I'm not in the K-12 classroom right now. That's correct.
But our session title is about not leaving the classroom. Which we clearly, to some extent, have some good advice for. So wait, who's in the classroom? Sam? And okay, so we got a good three of us.
Yeah.
The rest of you, the question is like, what the heck, right? Anyway, so maybe that's a part of our question. You have experiences not leaving the classroom. I have experiences where I left the classroom because I realized that was not a pathway where I didn't feel like I could effectively advocate. So maybe we could just start off with who this is for. And I wanted just to frame a little bit of this. So I've been reading a whole lot about this wonderful person named Wendell Berry. And if you guys don't know Wendell Berry, he's not an education guy. He's this is his book, The Art of Commonplace, Agrarian Essays. And you're like, yeah, like agrarian essays. This is literally about agriculture and a little bit about religion. And it seems really weird, but I've been having these questions about the relationship between education and relationships of like ecosystems and the way that we, you know, think about sustainable living and agriculture. So this was one of my first thoughts. And one of the things that Wendell Berry talks about in side of this is he says that we've delegated all of the responsibilities to others. And so this is, he kind of talks about how like families don't farm anymore. Like we've all kind of become urbanites. Mm-hmm. We can't sustain ourselves. Like if big farming industries fell apart, like we would have nothing else. But it's raised other questions for me, which is like who's taking care of teachers? I want to say us. I know that I'm not a teacher right now, but who's taking care of us? Who makes decisions for us? And if you know about like Michael Apple and others, there's this whole phenomenon of de-skilled teachers. It's like the most important decisions for the teacher are ones that are not made by the teacher too often. So they're not ones that make decisions about their actual content standards. They're not ones who make decisions about the curriculum all too often, especially their assessments. These are out of their control. And by and large, more and more things are removed from their kind of purview and given up to kind of, like it says here, salesmen, agents, and bureaus, and experts of all sorts. So that's kind of my kind of big... What's that?
I said I'm not necessarily experts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Experts of all sorts is an interesting, like you can claim expertise, right?
Right.
Yeah. We're experts about writing literature, or about writing laws maybe, but not
And I would
people
call
people there
that
making
question.
The laws for.
You got it. So.
Well, and I think the sort of piggybacking on this notion about experts of all sorts and who feels ownership. Or who takes ownership of our profession. Ron Thorpe, who just very recently died, was president of the National Board, and he used to say that education suffers as a profession from overexposure. Because in our society, unlike in what Chris was talking about, where kids are not in school past sixth grade, in our society, everybody has been through more than the 10,000 hours that supposedly makes you an expert of watching somebody do teaching, and they think by extension that they have now understood what it means to teach, and therefore they feel very, very empowered. And there's obviously arrogance. I am not going to say it's not arrogant, but it's not without some foundation. I mean, most of us haven't spent 10,000 hours watching somebody practice medicine. Most of us haven't spent 10,000 hours watching somebody do law. So we have this disconnect, which makes us more reverent about those professions because we don't have this close awareness or exposure to them that we do have with education. And it's very easy to, we know this even with experts, meaning teachers watching other teachers, that we tend to watch each other and attach to the surface features. It's part of the challenge of working on professional development with others around what it takes to build expertise. Genuine deep expertise is to look past surface features to see where the important decisions are and the subtleties and recognize that. So why wouldn't we think that somebody who's going to watch it without having that lens specifically given to them is going to look at teaching as the surface features? And we know that one of the things that many of us strive for, because we think it's better for our kids, we don't want to look panicked. It's not productive for my kids to see going across my face. Oh, that just tanked. I don't even need to think, is this gonna work? What am I doing? Oh my God, and then shut down, So that's not productive. So all of that gets, sort of smoothed away. And so what gets, it's watching the swan on the lake. It's supposed to look like glass, and beautiful, and calm, and easy. I mean, one of the things I very often say is, it is obscenely hard to make it look this easy. But people have watched for more than 10,000 hours somebody make it look easy, so they think, oh, this is easy. I get it. I know this. I understand this. So when they try to take ownership, or do take ownership, they don't feel completely unschooled. They've been schooled. So they think they understand school.
We had student surveys this year, and it was the first time we rolled out like district student surveys, and one of the questions was, does your teacher change their lesson plan if things aren't going well? I was like, I never announce that I'm changing my plan. Like, I keep saying yes. All the time. You know, not like, oh, I was going to do this, and now I realize that none of you know how to do it, so I'm going to do that.
I'm way far behind, but right. I'm going to keep going. Sorry, guys.
Right.
Children,
please note on your
cereal. Right now, changing what I
was going to walk over. I was going to say to your planning book, right? Rip out that page.
Right. Yeah.
So maybe one of the things that we think that we can do is we want to kind of pose this as we. So in our conversations, we talked about the difference between this being a little bit of an opportunity to lead, advocate, and become a steward, which we'll explore all of these to some extent. And then kind of maybe a part of it is being a little more pushy, like maybe it's an obligation, which I don't want to stress anybody out, but maybe that's kind of... That's
I do.
Okay, so maybe we want to... like, collectively, we want to push you to push on this.
But I want you to be stressed. I want you to be stressed for good purpose, as opposed to what the general zeitgeist in our culture right now is stressing you for no good purpose. I want you to be stressed for good purpose.
Yeah, that's perfect. So... So we kind of want to run through leadership, the three kind of main ideas, and just be very conversational about it. And to do that, I'm going to have some driving quotes from Wendell Berry. So this is a significant one about leadership.
Can I comment on that?
That is certainly the plan.
In Ontario, where I'm from, the PD for the masses... is no longer happening. So the train the trainer is done. And so basically all the money in Ontario, if you want money to work on something, you put in a proposal, and if you have an idea that you want to work on, so the ministry will then give you, fund you, allow you to release time, maybe give you some supporting resources if you want them, and you work on an idea that you have. So you have to send them a proposal, it has to get accepted. And if they like it, they allow you to go do that, but the deal is you got to go and present and share at the provincial conferences, and you have to put the stuff on their shared website where people can go and read it and look at it. But all their funding is going to that. That's how they're funding. That's how they're getting. They're finding they're getting more change now doing that than when the old PD for the masses were people would just be like, yeah. Because I had to,
right?
You know.
So are you meaning to suggest that they're taking this kind of anti-big thought approach? That they're thinking little. I mean, is that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what I'm saying. That they're letting it happen at the grassroots and build.
I was gonna say it's coming this way, as opposed to going that way.
Exactly.
So, for this kind of idea, you said, but if you want funding to do that, isn't that? And you started, then you, so tell me why, what kind of funding you need to do this?
They just have different programs in our province. They call it Teacher Leadership and Learning Program, and so you're allowed to apply for this money if you have an idea to explore. And it's not just restricted to mathematics, it's restricted to any subject area across discipline. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter, but if they like it, if they think it's going to be something that's in the right direction, mm-hmm. towards what the curriculum documents are saying, that they're going to give that money to go and do it. And so it's a 1 year cycle. You have a year to do it, you submit a report at the end. Then you go and at the end of that year, you have to, you know, for the next 6 months, you have to go and share it and sell it again.
I think that one of the interesting things that I probably get asked the most about, you know, from teachers' perspectives is our questions about, I want to do these things and I don't know who to get approval from, or I don't see myself in a role where I can just kind of get those things done. So time and again, folks basically are telling me they are not a designated leader and therefore they are not a leader. They're not an administrator, like you can name any kind of thing, right? Since I'm not designated, I am therefore not a leader. And I think this is one of the things that I've really tried to convey and, you know, promote, mm-hmm. is that there are types of leadership that we identify, like clearly, no offense to the folks in the room, but like maybe you're a president of a national organization or an executive director, right? Or I'm a statewide director. Like I have a really fantastic title, but there are people who have more opportunities to lead than they could ever, maybe they've never even realized. And the way that I felt is until I say, actually, if you're the one who's doing it, then you are leading in your own way. And I think that's something that whenever I come to MITBOS and TMC, this is why I come. It's because I realize that the people who are leading me are people who aren't my designated leaders, but they're the people who are making the biggest difference for me.
Right.
So we just kind of wanted to explore, should we explore leadership a little bit? Right. What it means in the classroom?
So for me, one of the things that I think made it easier for me, that I didn't start out having, you know, hearing myself even, sort of the internal conversation, I never said to myself, well, but it's not my job, or I don't have that, or that's not it, or I don't, because I didn't start my work life as a teacher.
And I'm in the same position, and I agree with that 100%.
Coming from another career, I already had an expectation of what it means to be in a profession, and owning this notion of part of, to me at least, one of the hallmarks of a profession is that as a practicing professional, you advocate on behalf of your profession. That's what we do. And the notion that each of us has a responsibility not only to the current state of the profession, but the future of the profession, to pitch in, do whatever you see, build opportunities as you see them needed, and then pony up, if you will. And the notion that you're expected always to be helping everybody collectively move towards excellence, and accept the fact that none of us can get there on our own. So really a commitment to the community, to the profession at large, including this built-in notion that part of what you have to do is to advocate for the profession and educate the broader community, or meaning the universe, if you will, but what our profession does and what we contribute. For those of you that don't know me really, I spent 15 years as a licensed registered architect. Actually, I'm still registered. I have 5 hours of community training I have to do between now and Friday to renew my license. But so
like you're on work release or something.
You mean next
no,
Friday?
No, my architectural license. 15 years.
Next Friday. You mean
yeah.
next Friday, right?
Yeah.
Not today?
Not today. Next Friday.
Are you sure?
Yes, I am. It's the very first. But in any event, but I came into then teaching already having these ideas about this is a profession, this is what I'm supposed to do. Okay, you guys have these titles, but those describe your job obligations. Those don't, to me, confine what it is you're supposed to contribute to the profession. Hopefully those are related, but they're not synonymous. And I don't know that most people coming into teaching have that view of what the bigger work might be of being a professional within this work.
Yeah.
So, kind of piggybacking off that, but maybe not totally, maybe going off onto a tangent. I was thinking about, as you were talking about that, how when you become a teacher and you enter the classroom, you're a teacher.
Yeah.
And you're a teacher. And you're a teacher. And you're a teacher. Well, if you and your best friend enter two different professions at the same time, you're a teacher, they're a peon. Whatever their peon title is, they're a peon. Year two, you're a teacher, they're still a peon. Year three, you're a teacher, they maybe move up to slightly better than a peon, but not a peon.
Not quite a peon.
Right. And maybe at 5 years, you're teaching and they're now 2 steps away removed from peon, but maybe not a manager yet. And at 10 years, you're a teacher and maybe your department head, because you were volunteered or somebody saw something. As my principal would say, you were voluntold that yes, you're now department chair. Or if there aren't department chairs in your school, as was my case, you are the de facto department chair. And your friend, rather than being a peon, is manager of peons. And I guess the point I'm trying to get at is if you are not in education, there is some sort of hierarchical structure that you work through, and I'm just a peon. Oh, I'm not a peon anymore. anymore. I'm a step away from peon, whatever that, you know, and as they get promotions and they have something that is expressive as a title of, well, I'm not just some entry-level professional anymore, I am a whatever professional, that that people in general recognize as, okay, you've worked hard, you paid your dues, and you've been given more responsibilities, sometimes quicker than others, but you know, you're a leader, and so on and so forth. And I don't think in education we have that if you are staying in the classroom.
No.
You are still a teacher. At 23 years experience, I am, by title, still a classroom teacher. I'm not just a teacher. Notice that I'm not putting that word just, because we have a tendency to do that as educators, to say, well, I'm just a teacher. No, you're not just a teacher, but granted, your title is teacher. And, I mean, it's not like there's a provision or whatever to say now that after 23 years and I've achieved X, Y, Z, P, D, and Q, that no, Lisa is not a math teacher, she is now a master math teacher, or a, you know, or something that indicates you've achieved something in your field.
Yeah.
And I think some, one of the things I've watched, especially in the last, help me stand here, two or three years, is we see good quality teachers leave the classroom, because what other difference can they make? Because you're a teacher, you're a teacher, you're a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So instead you look for a tech coach position, or a math coach position, or a professional development specialist or curriculum specialist at your county level, or whatever that equivalent is, where you go to
Desmos,
or you go to, I mean, we, those of us who are active enough in the community, know the list of things people have left the classroom for and gone to. And I mean, how do we break that cycle, but yet still give teachers some meaning, in a sense of, these are meaningful things I can do to help make a difference in my profession,
yeah,
to feel like I have some recognition that I have not been just a teacher for 23 years and I have nothing else to show of it, as I'm having dinner conversation with my friend Edmund here, who maybe is a lawyer and is now a partner in his firm, and my friend Tina here, who is head of the nursing department, and my friend Sam here, who is not only a brilliant neurosurgeon, but he is now the sheriff. You get the idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
And here I am, Lisa Henry, teacher, 23 years experience, thank you very much. Even though in the back of your mind, idealistically and realistically, you know, you have affected thousands, thousands of young people in one way or another, either mathematically or through your interaction, and don't really have anything that I can show for it other than wonderful YouTube videos that people say, well, I'm not just a teacher, I touch, you know, touch the future, as we've seen in a few places.
I feel like that's pretty much the biggest issue, right? You've nailed it on the head, and I think this is the question of career ladder is the hardest question to answer. And the people who are trying to figure this out have done it in a way that actually has almost achieved all of the opposite results, right? So career ladders that are focused on teacher effectiveness evaluations have basically just marginalized tons of folks.
They're driving people out of the profession left and right.
And not exclusively, right?
Right?
It can be done well, but do you have some comments?
Yeah, I think you, the first example Lisa started with you and the peon, who may not be a lawyer or a surgeon, but might be a bank manager, or might be the guy who runs a supermarket. They could be anything. For me, and I'm a second career teacher as well, and I started pretty late when I was 45, I started to teach. But when you decide to be a teacher, you made a decision to do that, and that's what you were day one. When the peon got a job at the bank, he didn't know what the heck he was gonna be at the end, but on day one he was a teller, right? So I think in some cases, you decided what to do and you start right away. That's a pretty good thing. Now, what makes you think 16 years in, if that's not what you'd want to do anymore, then you find another job, just like the guy in the bank did. But I don't understand the stigma attached, or the way teachers feel that I worked for 23 years and I'm still just a teacher. No, I don't see that myself. I've worked for 17 years, I'm a teacher.
I think part of it though is the broader, again, that broader media cultural phenomena that's happening and has been happening and the shift that's been happening around teacher as scapegoat. My husband has a cartoon which apparently has been ripped off by everybody who can draw or trace or whatever. Yeah, exactly. No, it is. It's like all variations of it keep showing up in weird publications. But it's, every once in a while he does one that's really for me. It's a picture of parents like screaming at the kid holding the report card, right? And this is 1960. And then it's today and it's parents screaming at the teacher holding the report card and the kid is, and it's exactly the same image. Yeah, well, the original version is, yeah, that Daryl did that one day because I was bitching about something. But there's this sort of general national perspective that has changed around our work. Mm-hmm. There have frankly been, and we're getting way off track, but there have also been some changes, frankly, in ways that it's interesting to me, being of my age and having been an early and ardent feminist, that feminism has actually hurt our profession. Once upon a time, when this was one of the few careers that was open to women, really, really phenomenal women were in teaching. Now they're neurosurgeons and they're Supreme Court justices and they're, and once upon a time when your choices were very, very limited, phenomenally brilliant women were in the profession. And that, you know, raised it to a different level. There were all sorts of other issues, but it's one of the pieces that has been a changing component of our profession.
Framler's is born to that too.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so there have been things which were advances in some regards, which also our profession then, there were the unintended and the backslash kind of pieces that came into play. Going back to this notion about X number of years, you know, one plus however many, and you are, quote, the same job description. One of the things that and I know I felt a little uncomfortable with this notion about without stepping out of the classroom, but Tina and I have had this conversation because I didn't step out to become an advocate. I stepped out after, like I said, 15 years of doing that and wanting to do it on a bigger stage, having, you know, felt like I had gone as far as I possibly could, and frankly was getting really exhausted trying to do too many things at the same time. I don't know how specific we want to get around what might be opportunities, and I don't remember what the next slide is.
Just where we go more into advocacy, but I think I could say something about the career ladder. And the people in this room are perfect cases of this by and large. One of the things that we should really consider is that when we call teachers teachers, we give them credit for one part of their job. Teaching is not, to most people, planning, right? If you're planning, you're not teaching at that moment. If you're grading, you're not teaching in that moment. There are all sorts of things that we do as teachers that don't involve this, like, teaching, the component, right? I saw it and nod, maybe. My argument is that I think being called educators is a valuable kind of just simple change. And it's a really, I think it's just one of those like really small vernacular kind of things. But if you call people educators, then there's value in what they are seen to be doing, kind of other things that are related to education, and that's valid. But I think to your point, Lisa, there's, you know, you are clearly a person who's taken a leadership responsibility that you received no permission for, and no, there was nobody who designated you as that person. There was nothing other than a decision. Yeah.
But my
high
decision
council?
On your part.
Didn't we all have a vote?
Oh, there's a high council? No, okay, never mind. Yeah, I didn't.
Oh, yeah, but that's secret.
Yeah.
They're the ones wearing the special underwear.
Yeah.
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 So,
yeah.
Oh gosh.
But I think there's so much here that I think we have to remind ourselves. We need permission. We only need to ask permission from people if they've told us that we have to ask permission from them for these things. This is my attitude.
Or we can just apologize afterwards.
Yeah,
and go,
I say that, and that's what I really mean. Like, there's only been a few times when somebody has said, to actually go do this, you need to ask my permission.
Very seldom.
Has anybody ever put kind of barriers on what I can do from the get-go? And if they do, then I'm pretty much immediately like, wait a second, why would you immediately set those barriers for me? And I can question them. But what I
go to the parents and go, I've been given this opportunity, and I really think that there's value for your kids and me getting to do this. Like,
but I think that we should not forget that we have a lot of our power, that we are permission providers to ourselves. Like, we can offer ourselves permission, and we should, to step out of whatever may be expected or normal. For example, if there's a belief that there's a need for a career ladder that makes sense, there is nobody better suited to create a good plan for career ladders than teachers, right? Like, there should be a conversation had by teachers that exactly says, what are the types of layered responsibilities that one might take that would lead them into these other places? And maybe it doesn't come with pay initially, but the point isn't pay. Like, that's something later.
So right. Define career ladder to me. Are we talking just about words?
I'm gonna jump in on this. So there has actually been a study going on for a number of years, sponsored out of the National Research Council, comparing career trajectories and career ladders. I think they called about career trajectories where it started from. Looking at China, they're not looking at the kids and the test scores and everything else. They're looking at what is the preparation and the what does the career look like, a lifelong career as a educator in China versus what it looks like in the US. And in China, there are certain expectations and opportunities and support for becoming what's called a super rank teacher. They actually have teach-offs.
That sounds a lot like evaluating teachers.
It's not, but it's not, because the expectation is that X number of years in, you start to do, and I forget if it's 3 or it's 5, like where the little steps are, but one of the first things that you're expected to do is to take responsibility for helping to support somebody who's in year one. In year one, you don't teach independently, you teach along the side of, and you know, very much sort of the transition and the apprenticeship model that we see with, let's see, doctors and lawyers and architects and engineers and plumbers, but we don't do
journeyman
it.
Journeyman anything.
Exactly. Will they do something similar? By year 5, you're expected to be starting to do your own action research within your classroom. By year 7, you're supposed to be doing research that's with people at the universities who then are expected to be coming in and working with the teachers, because that's how it's structured. By year 9, you're publishing in, and I'm making up these numbers, so don't attach to the numbers. I'm giving you sort of exemplars. And I do have.
Really care about numbers.
We're math people. Now you have to trivialize it with numbers. And I didn't tell you which system of numbers anyway I was dealing with. So maybe it's 9 in some number. Anyway, but by year 9, you're publishing in sort of the local journals. And then at some point you are co-teaching at the university, and they have rankings that have to do with the contributions you are making, not just, so it's not the evaluation that we're talking about here.
Yeah.
It's about, what are you doing? Are you stepping in many of the same ways that within our own professions in the US, other than education, you get to have those other accolades or other letters or other sort of, you know, imprimaturas on you and little badges and glittery things and stamps and stuff.
Patches.
Right, exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Patches.
Right? So, but that is something. And then there are places where, okay, you know what, I've gone this far and I'm not really interested in becoming a super ranked teacher. I'm not really interested in becoming this. And I can choose, right?
But
I'm
there
happy.
Are options, important. And there are models.
Right.
We have a lack of models.
That's exactly
right.
What I was going to say, is that when I was thinking about like what it is to be a teacher leader that's still in the classroom, I'm like, who would I look to? And I'm like, the only people I can think of are people here who are doing things like outside the classroom. And it's funny because I'm like, oh, it's never been like my department head. It's never been like any of the PD people. Like, I don't even have access to people that I would say like I look up to, and who have influenced me in these like very strong ways. So I was like, oh, we have no models of this. And what you're describing is like, oh, there's like specific pathways and things that there's not only models of people, but of those actions that one can do about
right.
mentoring, about
yes.
like writing articles, collaborating with someone else, like working on a lesson study, like those specific
but
things. There's no like array of options that I even can think of. It's like random crap that I get to see.
So one of the, I got to go to one of the workshops that was part of the study was actually they brought a bunch of teachers from China, from primarily Beijing and Shanghai, and had this conversation with university people, again, from Beijing and Shanghai, and a bunch of American researchers, math educators, and math teachers, and had a conversation comparing, and having been invited as one of the teachers, one of the things that I pointed out was every single thing I have done that is considered math teacher leadership is something I had to find. Mm. This notion of a career trajectory in the US as a teacher leader is something that looks different for every single teacher leader because we are all inventing it from scratch.
Yeah.
We're making it up. Now, it has gotten a teeny, teeny, tiny bit better in terms of there being some more defined opportunities. Levi has done some incredible work in Oklahoma that I got to find out about through talking with him. There are more and more states which are creating teacher advisory councils that are actually tasked by the state government with giving input into legislation. And they're, you know, in particular looking at science and math because, you know, STEM is sexy these days, so we're pulling people into that. California has a California Teacher Advisory Council. I know that there is one in Michigan. I know that there is there one in Massachusetts? I forget where else there are ones. There is also a National Teacher Advisory Council, the NTAC, which is part of the National Research Council. Now, is that something that's gonna do it for every teacher? Of course not, but leadership also gets to be smaller numbers, and so at some point there get to be less and less of those people doing that work. There have been some initiatives within the Department of Education. There have been some major initiatives actually coming out of National Board lately. There's one called Teach to Lead, which if you haven't looked into, might be something that is of interest to you. There is an initiative coming out of the Department of Education that I think they took so damn long making it happen that now I think they are pulling it back and rebranding it, but I kid you not, they actually came up with something with the acronym RESPECT.
Yeah, because that's education.
Yeah, because of course that, because all it's going to take is for Arne Duncan to stand up there and spout the, for me to feel, you know, like, I got it. Yeah.
So when you say, I don't know if it's that's going to do it for teachers, what's the it we're talking about? Do what for teachers?
To give them that voice. To make sure that we feel that the profession is moving in directions that are serving the ultimate needs of kids. Full disclosure of, you guys know who these guys are.
Yeah.
I was having a conversation the other day about why I care about NCTM, and I said, I am deeply vested in NCTM. I care deeply about the organization because I think they are uniquely positioned with potential to accomplish things that I care about. Namely, I think they have the best shot of making things better in classrooms for the learning, teaching and learning of mathematics. So that's why I care about that. Thinking about why I care about some of this work and when I'm saying the it ultimately is to make the profession more able to accomplish its mission at the highest level.
But I think in your case, nothing prevents you from being active in NCTM or doing the kind of advocating
Does.
Nothing stops Lisa Henry from doing
no.
the kind of leadership stuff she wants to do. Does something
It depends on what it is, because I know, I mean, you're talking about that and I'm thinking about, and I told my principal I did it. Ohio, you may or may not be aware, pulled out of PARC. They're now going with tests through the American Institutes of Research, and they have put out a call for people to serve on the committee, which I went ahead and put my name in. I kind of like did it and told my principal, hey, I did this, because I'm tired of not having a
time out of the classroom.
But it's time out of the classroom.
Yeah.
And I know that to go and do some of these things, my number one hang up is time out of the classroom. And my second hang up is money.
Yeah.
And they aren't always in that order, but it's always those two things. Like Sam just pulled up the Teach to Lead, and it's, you know, with National Board.
I would love to get my National Board certification because that is something I can do as a teacher to say, hey, I have improved my practice. I can't afford to do it.
No.
I have two kids and my district is in financial issues and has been with the state for a couple of years. They do not pay a dime for me to come here and do this. I have run this for 4 years and I have gotten not a penny. And although my superintendent knows that I do this, I've gotten no recognition up at the level from the superintendent, and we're not a big district, and I doubt that our 5 school board members know that I do this national conference for 200 teachers that makes a huge impact in so many districts across the United States. Mm-hmm. My principal knows, and again, I was told that, you know, didn't ask permission, beg forgiveness later on, and she's incredibly supportive of it, from a moral support standpoint. But she can't give me money, and I know that, and she knows that, so I don't bother to ask.
Yeah.
But as much as I want to do these
things, the two barriers
mm-hmm. in some semblance of our order are time and money.
So
always.
So before we kind of get into advocacy, maybe this is a good transition point to go to mm-hmm. advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
Around 60 years ago, NCTM promoted the idea that teachers would have an annualized position and salary. So what would happen if teachers were 12-month employees kind of question? Like, what if the best of our teachers, and best being something that we can define other ways and other times.
Yeah.
But what if some of our folks had access to 12-month employment? And let's call them educators, because again,
for like actually a quarter more money, not just like
right.
Well, not to
yeah.
be
a third
money.
More, a third
that's
more money.
My ex,
right?
My
no,
ex
no,
salary,
no,
and
it's
more patient.
Well, I guess it depends on
what
your salary.
Yeah,
like in Oklahoma, you're 9 months.
Yeah.
You get a 9 month salary. So we're talking like take that, get yourself a third more.
Yeah.
So
it's
one
a third
more.
Fourth
more.
A third more.
Yeah.
That's
you know what?
A third more.
Even a
this is a great math problem.
No, you're right.
Although I have to say, when university employees go from 9 months to 12 months, they get a quarter more.
Do they? Seriously?
Well, that's
yeah.
bad math.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is
so
the summer session is
math fail harder?
So
no, it's just. It's 3 months of salary. Yeah, point it
yeah.
sounds right. Oh, it's a quarter of the year.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
quarter
no,
quarter.
But they don't do percentage changes.
So there's the big thing. There is not. It's not saying let's keep kids year round. Give them all the time. We're saying, what does an educator do when they don't have kids? There's a whole heck of a lot that we do. And what we should keep in mind is that we are.
About my teacher or my wife is a lazy bum in the summer.
Yeah,
and that's made the rounds in the last couple of weeks.
So I want to kind of move to this point and kind of take this idea about leadership and remember, one of the things about leadership is it doesn't require designation. This is a decision primarily, and later designations may occur. But what has to happen is you have to decide to lead, and that's it. And that's a thinking small kind of thing. In advocacy, this is an interesting quote, or at least I think it is from Wendell Berry again.
And I will tell you that my reaction when Levi shared this quote with me was after having read the first line. Do you guys all know who Pasi Sahlberg is? I think he's the former head of education. I don't think he's still the education from Finland, okay? And speaks very eloquently, but very, very broadly about what lessons really, in fact, his book is called Finnish Lessons. In any event, he routinely says that in the US we have no public education system, we have a system of slogans. That's what we have.
Oh.
We have public education slogans. We don't have a system of education.
No, slogans and TLAs.
According to him, we have slogans.
And they
all
get the first
letter,
there's two letters.
We're fast moving away to FLAs because we've run out of all the TLAs. There's a limit.
Four and five, yeah.
Five letters I'm going for now.
So I think this is the thing that I see. There's the advocacy, and this is what I've learned from Peg so much, is advocacy is I think this is a responsibility that we all have. We meaning the people who are closest to the classroom, are the ones who are the very most aware of the needs and should be thinking about the opportunities for improvement and things of this effect. And it is primarily that voice that needs amplification. But the amplification, that, have you guys, maybe somebody a moment ago said this, that we need to have a voice at the table? Have you ever heard that? It's our table. Like, we don't need a voice at the table. It's our table.
That's right. Yeah.
It's our table, but no one invited us to sit at it. It's like,
yeah.
It's your table, but
we're going to take your place.
Well,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We can have our own table. Like, we are having our own table, but
you got it.
We're not the decision makers.
You want to be sure it's not the children's table, the card table that
yeah.
you yeah.
right.
right?
In the other room.
And this
yeah.
is the point is, to some extent, we have to figure out what are the solutions that we want. And then we have to advocate for those things. And then we will be reckoned with. And that just seems like a really strong word. But identifying problems is easy. Everybody can do it. And primarily they're wrong. Identifying the root cause and then coming up with a solution that actually can lead to change is incredibly challenging. And this is the thing that I think that especially folks in this room and others need to really be considering, you know, actively.
I think the other thing that people very often get hung up on when I talk about advocacy and my advocacy efforts is the notion that that happens. It's differentiable. It's completely smooth. It happens at all possible levels. And the fact that you don't yet feel equipped, or you don't yet see a path for, or you don't entirely know how to create an avenue towards doing that stuff, doesn't mean that you can't start down here. I will tell you that being a loudmouth, you got to use it for something. I was actually shy as a child. People always think I'm joking about that. But I was seriously shy as a child. But when I went into a profession, which was when I started in architecture, it was 4% women. 4% women. Yeah, exactly. I already kind of was the oddball, go figure. I knew I needed to be able to speak for myself. I needed to speak on behalf of the profession. I needed to speak a variety of things. It made it a lot easier when I started in the classroom then to feel like, you know what? My kids don't have a voice. When it really comes to what is advocacy to my way of thinking, it's giving voice to things that matter and lending your voice on behalf of somebody who doesn't have power or standing or whatever to speak and to say what needs to be said. It really is speaking truth to power. And so I found it much easier to speak because I was speaking on behalf of somebody else than speaking on behalf of myself. And part of, I think, why I find it much easier to be an advocate is because I care so deeply about the kids. If we don't get things better for the profession, we're not gonna be able to make things better for the kids. So this isn't advocating on behalf of teachers. It's advocating on behalf of teaching, because teaching is what makes learning possible, from my perspective. I'm not saying it's the only thing, but it's certainly a critical thing. Taking that one step further around this idea of advocacy was then learning about how advocating within this arena, within education, as a teacher, what voice I could take, and when I was actually doing more harm than good. And I think that's a really critical thing that a lot of teachers do not see, is that it's very, very easy to get very angry no matter what sphere you're working in, right? Whether you're working in a classroom and you're mad because of testing, or you're mad because of lack of funding, or you're mad because you've got kids in your room that are not paying attention because they're hungry. There's so many different parts of this work that it makes sense to be, if you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention kind of thing. It's really, really hard to be heard if you're shrieking. And it's really, really hard not to shriek when you get really, really angry. And that's not something that's comes to me naturally, because I get really hard and I get really angry, and it's really hard for me to keep it. And my husband, who is annoyingly even-tempered, we've been married 30-some years, I've seen him get angry twice, and nobody else in the room knew he was angry. Okay? He is annoyingly even-tempered. But he is a really good metric for me of saying, you're hurting yourself. You're just pissed off and nobody's listening to you anymore because you're screaming, you're ranting. So thinking about it's not just about, I'm going to yell because I'm mad enough. No, the point of advocacy is to be heard. It's not just to yell. Part of that lesson was taught to me, as I said, by my husband, who, you meet him, you'll get it. Part of that lesson was taught to me by Chris Shore, who I am so excited to see him here. I've known Chris for a very long time as a fellow teacher in California. And Chris, many, many, many moons ago, did a talk at a California math conference, which were iconic leaders through the ages talking about leadership. And he's putting up these iconic photos of, you know, and talking about which dimension of leadership. And he puts up Jesus. And of course, you know, it's this huge room and people are all murmuring about what, and he goes, and you may not, you, I have this up here for a reason that you may not have thought of. It followers, it disciples. If you're leading and there's nobody with you, you're not a leader, you're a guy out taking a walk. And I sat there, and I can do that, and that is verbatim, okay? Because
yeah,
those words are seared onto my memory, because I thought, oh, crap. Part of advocacy, if we're really talking about leadership and leading and advocating as a leader, is that you get others, like-minded or otherwise, to join with you, which also means learning to work with people who, it's the Venn diagram thing. Is the overlap sufficient that I can join with you around this? I'm over here, you're over here, but this, we can go together, and then all of a sudden, that voice gets doubled, but it doesn't, it gets squared, it really is exponential, it's not multiplicative. But you've got to find ways of being heard. And in particular, I'll tell you, aside from the shrieking thing, the other thing that I have learned, and I...
Sorry.
Okay, all right. Like,
movement.
My family would go, oh, Peg, shiny object. But the other thing I will tell you about this notion of how to temper your voice, aside from the sort of just letting all of the anger out, which winds up not being productive typically, is that unlike in architecture, where the fact that I was an architect speaking on behalf of architecture usually meant that people listened to me, that as a teacher speaking on behalf of teaching, I found that that usually diminished my voice, and that the expectation was that I was being defensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to learn how to speak in ways that really didn't sound so personal as to sound defensive. Because again, it was that metric of, am I helping or am I hurting? Because if I'm being very, very public, if I'm being very, very visible, and what I am, the net effect is that I am hurting, then get the hell off the soapbox, go back into the classroom, because you're not contributing, you're self-aggrandizing. And that's not a real easy thing to do if you've got something to say, but figuring out where those lines were something I had to do in those early years of how do I do this work so that it accrues to the benefit of the people that matter, and that's not me.
I think to strengthen the thing about when you start to hurt, also recognize when you win. When you come up and So when you go in to do an advocacy, have an idea of what it is you want to achieve. You go into a meeting with somebody, have a clear idea of what you want to achieve. And I've been in situations where I've come out with exactly what I wanted going in, and I was also frustrated because they didn't get quite enthusiastic enough, or they didn't agree with, they gave me what I wanted but didn't quite agree with me that was the right thing. And so when you go into these things, analyze carefully, because sometimes you've already won the argument even though someone's still arguing with you. The thing that you're arguing for is happening, and the fact that they don't agree with you on everything doesn't matter.
So, in respect of our time, I want to move us a little bit. So, to tell two very small stories. One is, in Oklahoma, every single year, there's a bill that would require 4 years of math for all students to graduate.
You have that?
What's that?
We have that. Uh-huh.
You have that. So in my role, I am opposed to that bill. And I have to advocate in all sorts of venues to convey what issues I have with that, and what I think the other opportunities are. When I presented a research brief to the senators who wrote the bill, they basically said, thanks but no thanks, like, we're doing this. They give us a better reason than all the research. That's basically what they said. And so I had to come back out of my very frustrating meeting with them, which they basically listened to every 15th word of yours. And I had to develop an entirely new bill. I wrote an entirely new bill for them. And I said, this is a better bill, and it's one that we'll support. That bill passed that year. They took their bill off, and they put this bill on, and it passed. The bill allowed for space for students to take a fourth-year math or science course, as opposed to requiring them to take a fourth-year math course only. So this is a small thing. Now, the math or science course, like the opportunity here, it seems like such a small thing. But it didn't go in this kind of really scary space that it was going to, which is that our 500 districts who don't have enough staff couldn't handle it. And what we have evidence of is that students end up taking less rigorous courses when those things are required of them. Mm-hmm. So we came up with this other solution, which we found to be really valuable. And the senators responded to it because the work was there. Like, they didn't care what I was opposed to. They wanted to know what I was for.
Mm-hmm.
And once I was there, I was promoting a solution rather than telling them why theirs was wrong. And this is my lesson learned in my process of advocacy. I want to show you very quickly this. We won't actually listen to it because I don't have my audio set up. This little video right here.
Sorry.
Is, oh, wait, is there audio?
No, that was, oh, you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know it's really quiet.
We want to take just a moment of your time to talk about what we need as a school, a
district, community, city,
state, and country. We educators have been left out of important conversations and decisions about education.
We know there's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding about some of the heavy issues regarding education. We certainly don't have all the answers for each and every school. But we have a request. When a decision is to be made, please pause and ask, is this what's best for all kids in your community?
Not my kids.
Or her kids.
Or those kids.
All kids.
We need you to simply pause, gather information, and then make decisions.
Education desperately needs a renaissance, and not more reforms.
All right, so this guy right here is state teacher leader finalist in Oklahoma right now. He went through our OK Math leadership process last year, where through the course of a year, we ask them to define an issue that they're concerned about and create a solution. And at the end of it, this is what we call their Keystone Project. They have to enact their Keystone Project. His is called Teach Like Me. He's got a whole website and a whole campaign trying to get teachers to talk positively about teaching. And it's amazing because they have all these beautiful videos that he's putting together. But when I talk to him about his story, this is my biggest point. When I talk to him about the story of how he's come to all this, he said that nobody gave him permission for this. Like, he never asked anybody, hey, can I go change the way that people think about education in the United States? Right? Like, his principal, what didn't sign off on these things? There was literally somebody like me who's just like this guy who's like, hey, what if, you know, you spend a whole year working on a project and you get it going? And he's like, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And he did. And it's remarkable. The thing that he's done that's especially interesting is I think he shifted actually into this, not just advocacy, which I think is important, but also stewardship. And that's kind of where I want to make sure that we wrap up here. There we go. So this quote is maybe a little too heavy for what stewardship is. In the context of stewardship and land management, this is a story about production. For as little money as possible, can we get the most bang for our buck? So the story he tells is to get a bushel of corn, it requires 2 bushels of topsoil when done improperly. So in other words, that land will be unfarmable in no time. It'll be gone. It will be sucked dry. In education, there are similar things that happen. everybody is oriented toward efficiency in teaching to kind of the detriment of nurture and care and character and condition and quality and kindness. And I think that's one of the things that I want to kind of wrap this conversation up about is being a leader is critical, and you don't need anybody to say, go for it, you're there. Being an advocate is essential. It just has to happen. And again, nobody has to give you approval for that. Being a steward is really the very most difficult thing. And it's the people here are the ones who are thinking about this. So the ones who are making sure that the profession is fertile for generations to come. So when teachers like Chris Anderson had just said, like, what are we doing to take in our new teachers? Mm-hmm. MITBOS has a plan. We have an induction plan, right? I mean, I say,
absolutely.
I'm going to call myself we in MITBOS.
You are a part of this.
We have an induction plan. And we don't, most schools don't, most certainly beyond a school district, there are not effective induction plans. We have all sorts of things that focus on, look, I mean, this is what we do. Bottom right here. Did you hear anybody during this conference spend their whole time talking about data?
Numbers.
So I have a really, really enthusiastic and wonderful administrator who just tops on whatever is the most recent thing. And so he was at summer school, and we don't send kids out who have severe learning disabilities. We keep everyone in the school. So we have kids that have really behind. They're in high school, and the summer school teacher was like, oh, I'll just hand him a multiplication chart, see where his gaps are, like have him fill the thing in. The kid worked diligently, but it took him an hour to fill in a multiplication chart. Maybe it was up to 10, maybe it was up to 12, it really doesn't matter. He spent an hour working on this thing. And the administrator's response to like having watched that, you know, like come in, seen him working left, come in, seen him still working left, was, oh, we should collect some data on his starting point and then collect some data at the end of summer school. It's like,
sure,
that was data. Like, that is the data. You just watched him do it.
That's
you watched him do it very slowly. Like, if you could do it faster by the end of summer school, then you would have seen growth. But his understanding of data has to be like a multiple choice test or...
It has to be something that fits in an Excel spreadsheet or it's not data. Yes.
Right, but it's like, if you count how many minutes it took him, but like, it's a very narrow... understanding of like what he thinks in terms of, and that like perspective of like these are the things that matter.
It skews the way that we end up behaving. So I think this is
we're
out of time. What I have a personal kind of request. I would love, this is a very new exploration. I have more questions about stewardship than I have answers. If you guys end up thinking some about what stewardship potentially means in our profession, would you mind just sharing that with us?
Yeah, I was going to say in us.
Yeah.
As Levi alluded to, I am not currently in a K-12 classroom. I work for the Los Angeles Unified School District. I still have to have a timesheet. Lonnie is really amused by signing my timesheet for me, Lonnie Horn. But because I'm working at Vanderbilt University on detached service, so I am a de facto faculty member working with pre-service teachers and some in-service teachers. Part of what I've done, though, is because I wound up staying, I'm going back for year three of my one-year position, is that I started something that I call a math cult, because we are all about acronyms, so we are Community United and Learning Together, cult. And we meet very regularly at my house with teachers who in my first year were my student teachers and now are in their first year and they're about to start their second year, and some kids who were Lonnie's students before I got there who play well with others, and my kids that just, and I call them kids because they're younger than my own children, but my fellow teachers who just graduated who were about to start their beginning year.